Hello there, everybody.
Hi.
I'm Robin. I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hi, Robin.
Welcome to our workshop. We're going to, we have two speakers here, John and Nanette. I'll introduce our first speaker, Nanette, speaking on recovery from relapse. How would you like your time?
15:05,
is it
20 minutes?
Yeah, 15:05. Thank you. I'll keep track.
My name is Nanette. I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hi, Nanette.
You guys need a microphone? Okay, the back people said no. Okay.
Okay.
But if you can't hear me, just, you know. Mainly I came to OA to, let me check the time. To lose some weight so I could catch a man and then he would fix me, whoever that was. And I wasn't interested in changing my life. I just wanted a diet club that was free. And I had read something about alcoholism, maybe in college, and what I remembered reading is that the alcoholic feels awful about his drinking, and the only way to quiet that feeling is to have some more alcohol. Then he would feel very bad about that, and he would have to drink alcohol to quiet that down, and it was a snowball thing. And then I totally related to that, but not with alcohol, but with food. I would be dismayed because my stomach is dropping out there. And I couldn't stand the feeling, so I'd have to eat and then find the comfort. And that would make my stomach stick out some more, and then I have to eat over that. And it would just snowball. So when I knew that AA dealt with alcoholism, so when I heard about Overeaters Anonymous, I was interested. So I came here, and the first 2 years I was here, I went to maybe 3 or 4 meetings a week. And I had like next to no success. For the first 8 years I was in OA, I was absent 8 times. This current absence, the 8th time. And I've been absent 31 years, but the second longest time was 27 days. And the smallest, I was absent like 3 days, 4 days, 5 days. I'm not even counting those ones. And then maybe it was 15, 17, 27, something like that. And there's a big difference between 27 days and 31 years. So I sort of, each one of the abstinences I went on was meant to be the permanent forever one. And none of them ever were. My normal history with diet is 2 days average, 3 days max. Even a diet that I devised myself that I thought I could do, 3 was like I couldn't stand it anymore, that restricting, and I would have to bust out. And that would be overeating and maybe binging. So what happened that was different with this particular one that turned out to last, because the other 7 didn't take, and I meant for them to take, but they didn't. One of the things was that I discovered that I had the disease of perfectionism. And that in me, the disease of perfectionism was really powerful. It was as powerful as the disease of compulsive overeating. They were conjoined twins. If one twin got the flu, they both got the flu. And if one twin took an aspirin, it would be in both circulation systems. It was joined. So, having discovered that I had the disease of perfectionism, I had to recover from both at the same time, otherwise it just wasn't going to work because they were so joined. And just to give you an example of how I ate, I would go home from work and I would put 2 frozen dinners in the oven. This is when I was living by myself. And then I would go take a shower, put on a clean flannel nightgown, and then I would take those 2 meals out of the oven, I would have it, and I would really enjoy it. And I loved eating by myself, because there were no witnesses, anything I wanted. And then after that, maybe an hour later, I'd feel hungry. And so I made several sandwiches composed of room temperature butter on white bread with sugar sprinkled on it sandwiches. And several of those, maybe 3. And then before bedtime, I'd be hungry again. And then I would boil a bag of cream spinach and have a can of canned peaches, fruit cocktail, or canned pears. And then I would feel I could go to I could end my day. And I didn't eat that way every day, but it was not an unusual day for me to eat that way. So here I was trying to recover from the disease of perfectionism, and the only way I have ever found to recover from the disease of perfectionism is that when I'm imperfect, I have to keep it. Because every time I want to start fresh, I was practicing the disease of perfectionism, of it wasn't good enough. And one of the things I discovered about the disease of compulsive overeating in me, it's a black and white feeling I have. Am I doing it right or wrong? Is this good or bad? Did I do it right? Did I do it wrong? Is this abstinence or this not? You know, it has to be either or. And that's the voice of the disease, the demand for perfectionism and order. And the gray area makes me feel really uncomfortable, where I don't know whether I'm good or bad, did it right or wrong. But it turns out that how it is expressed in me is that the gray area is the part that is the recovery area. If the two extreme ends are part of the disease, and the recovery is the moderation in between, where I'm not sure. So, the very first thing I did in recovery was in this recovery, the eighth abstinence, was I realized that when I ate at a restaurant, I ate too many rolls. I got that. And it made me feel bad. So I said to myself, one of my guidelines for abstinence is, if I'm in a restaurant and if they have rolls, I'll have one roll and one pat of butter, no matter which runs out first. And that was my little guideline. And the reason I put it that way is because I take a roll and I use the butter and finish the roll, but there'd be a smidgen of butter left. To take the second roll to use up the butter, but it wasn't enough butter for the second roll, I have to open the second butter. And then there'd be a second butter left, I have to take a third roll and use it. You know, it just snowballed like that. So I said one roll and one pat of butter, no matter which runs out first. And so that's what I did, and I felt great. And then every last thing that they gave me in the restaurant, because I figured if they gave it to me, it was my portion, so I would eat anything I wanted. Last grain of rice, decorative lettuce, anything, it was mine. And I knew it was big, it's big, you know, but it was mine, my portion. And I knew that wasn't anything you could lose weight by. So I said my very first prayer in recovery, and it was this prayer. Dear God, I hope you'll clean up my food later, because I can't do it now. And unbeknownst, I don't know why, but I started to lose weight, giving myself the big leeway. And in one restaurant, they had three different kinds of rolls in that basket. So then the big debate, should I have one that looks best, one kind? And I somehow knew that it was a bad idea for me to feel deprived. So they have to have three different kinds of rolls. So I had three rolls, one of each kind, and they all shared the same pat of butter. And I felt great. It was another abstinent meal. I don't know how much time I have left.
Well, I've been over 12.
12 minutes?
So let's make it 12.
Okay. One of the things in the other abstinences that I didn't do was do the steps, starting with step one, because I had learned that you do the steps, and each as you do each step, practice each step, it builds on the previous one. So you have to do them in order so they build on, because the answers might come from a previous step, and if you don't do them in order, then you won't get the answers you need. And I had, in the interim, during the 8 years, I found that I qualified for another 12-step program for friends and families of alcoholics. And it was that program that I hit a bottom. And bottom for me is not what gets you to the program, but it's what makes you become willing and teachable. And I started to transform in the other 12-step program. The biggest transformation, at least outwardly, and I was still eating compulsively all this time, but I had recovery in the other 12-step program that did not deal with a substance, but with people. And one of the biggest transformations is the lessening of my shyness. I was so shy that I would take an F and do an oral book report. If I took a class and I knew an oral presentation was involved, I dropped out as soon as I found that out. So the fact that I'm actually speaking for like so far, it's a big transformation. Big, huge, huge, huge. The first time I was asked to lead a meeting, it happened to be in the other 12-step program, like a series leading of meetings. It was only a 5-minute share, but I didn't think I could do it. It was too scary, too, like I would die than do it. And I went to my sponsor, and I told her that I was so scared, I don't think I can do it. And she said, "Has the program helped you?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Then you have something to share." And then she actually turned away and walked away. And so, but I got it. If you've gotten something, you have something to give back. It doesn't matter whether you know what you have to give back or not. If you've gotten something, there is something to give back. So I led that meeting, and it was just fine. And so it built from there. So anyway, Meals at Mealtime with Life in Between. Step one said, "I'm powerless over food and my life has become unmanageable." And I'll just address the first part of the first step. I'm powerless over food. That step is about powerlessness. I've heard people say that that step is about honesty. Honesty is an aspect of that step, but it's not about honesty. It's about powerlessness. I'm powerless over food. I was never, ever willing to do that step because I didn't want to be powerless over food. I came to OA to get power over food, to control my food, to eat portions that were teeny-weeny portions and choose the right food 100% of the time. I don't want to be powerless. So I never did that step. But here I was being miserable and eating the way I was, and I decided that I didn't want what I had. And for the first time ever, I was willing to take something other than what I had. See, before I had criteria for those for the recovery. It had to look like this, this, and this. Otherwise, it wasn't a recovery enough for me. But now I had a little shift in perspective. I just didn't want what I had. And whatever I could do that was better than what I had, I'll take it. That was a big switch. It took 8 years to get that switch. And so I had to write about being powerless over food, and I just did not want to be powerless over food. I actually didn't believe you guys were powerless over food. You were just controlling it better than I was. And so in the writing, the reason I can't be powerless is because I was using my personal power to hold the weight down to the scary weight for me. The scary weight was 200 pounds. I had to use that power to cut it off at the pass, not ever even go near 200 pounds. So I needed the power to do that. And you're saying I have to be powerless to recover. So I have to be powerless to recover, or don't be powerless and never recover. It was catch 22. But since I had recovery already in another 12-step program, I knew those steps worked. And the way I did that step in my other 12-step program was this. For me to ask an alcoholic not to drink was like for me to ask a tubercular not to cough. The guy who has TB has to cough because that's what his disease made him do. That's part of the disease. He can't cough and say, "This is the last time I'm going to cough. I will never cough again. I'm working 12 steps and never coughing again." Because if he says that, he is saying two things at least. One, I have power over a cough. And two, I don't have a real disease. So I know TB is a real disease. I know you have totally no power over a cough. So I had to translate that in OA. I'm powerless over food. And I felt fraudulent because actually I was here to get power over food, not be powerless. How can, you know? But since I knew the steps worked, I thought I'd give it a try. It was very hard to be powerless over food. I felt like a fraud, so I had to act as if. And my cough was the overeating and binging. And a tubercular cannot blame himself for coughing. So I couldn't blame myself for overeating and binging. I felt I should blame myself, but I had to act as if I didn't. And then I could think, how can anybody get abstinence if it's okay to binge and overeat? So one thing I read in the AA 12 and 12 was that, thank you, that if you're powerless, you're willing to do stuff you would never ordinarily do. And one of the things I don't like to do if I want to binge is I don't want to be interrupted. I might tell you afterwards, tell you how bad I've been, but before, when I'm planning the binge, I want to do it. Not only do I want to do it, I have to do it. It just, I have to do it. I don't know why, I don't want to, but I have to. So my job to do something I can do, which is to call somebody. And after I call them, it's totally okay to binge and overeat, because that's a way to be powerless over food. And I tried being powerless over food in other ways. I tried talking about it, writing about it, thinking about it, asking God about it. But nothing ever traveled up beyond my head. And I had to really believe the powerlessness, get it in my gut. And the only way to make the powerless in my gut is to make it okay to binge and overeat. Because if I'm truly powerless, it has to be okay. So, kept acting as if. And when I was abstinent 3 months, which is already a miracle because I hadn't been abstinent more than 27 days, now it's 3 months. And one day, about 4 p.m., nobody was home, my husband was out, I had to binge. I just needed that big relief. And I always overate and binge for relief, and I didn't know that until in retrospect. I needed that relief so bad, I didn't want to ruin my abstinence, but I had to. Just for the hell of it, I called somebody first. And after I call her, then I'll binge. And somebody I didn't know had shoved her phone number at me at a meeting. Call me if you need to. So I decided to call her because I didn't know her. And so I called her and I said, I'm Nanette, I met you at X meeting and I want to binge. And she says, you must really want to recover because you called me. And until she said that, I didn't know that. I didn't know I really wanted to recover. And she said, but that doesn't mean I wasn't going to binge. I was still going to binge. So she said, when would you like to start binging? And I thought, this is easier than I thought. She didn't say what's going on. Let's talk about none of that. Just when would you like to start binging? And I said, 6 o'clock, because it looked more like dinner at 6 o'clock. She said, can you wait until 6? I said, yes. She said, don't binge until 6. I said, okay. And we hung up. That was like 2 minutes max. So then I had 2 hours to kill. So I went and fixed the bed, and I went through the dishes in the sink, and then I grabbed the TV guide, and I was grabbing the remote and channel hopping. Just channel hopping, watching vid, moving around, and suddenly I looked at the clock, and it was 6:15. It was 15 minutes past my binge start, and I hadn't started. I could have been binging 15 whole minutes. And knowing that I could have been binging freely for 15 minutes and hadn't done it, I suddenly didn't want to binge anymore. So I fixed dinner, which was a little mountain on a plate, and I ate this entire mountain. But the thing is, the meal ended at the edge of the plate. It didn't travel onto the kitchen. There wasn't more. It ended. So I subscribe to the notion that the miracle for us isn't that we eat 3 times a day, it's we stop 3 times a day. And that was another day of abstinence. I mentioned that I was abstinent. This is my 8th abstinence. And I have to share with you how I see this. I don't see that I've had 7 relapses. I saw all those 7 times that I couldn't stay abstinent as attempts at recovery. Because in my own mind, I separate the term abstinence from recovery. Because abstinence can be a diet in disguise. But recovery is something else. Recovery is a line I cross and I never cross back. It's a state of being, and I can't explain it, except that when I got there, at first I didn't know I got there. It was still, you know, as I evolved, I realized I had crossed that line into recovery. And I've never had a relapse since I crossed that line into recovery. And the other 7 times were only attempts at recovery, starting with the food, because I came here for the food. And my time is probably over, but I'll just end with this one thing, how I envision my recovery. I see my recovery like a forest. And the trees in the forest are days of abstinence. And there are enough trees in the forest to make the forest, trees in the forest to make the forest forest. And some of these trees are like firs and Christmas trees and oaks and sequoias. It's a wonderful, luscious tree. But some of these trees are dead. They're like tree stumps, maggots crawling through them, letting it hit it, stop growing. But there's more to my forest than trees. There are waterfalls and streams and California poppies and clover. And over there is a meadow. And the meadow, past that meadow is a grove of tree stumps. Because I look at a forest and I know that it's God-given and God-made. It has nothing to do with me. It's nature. And I have to accept everything that's there, no matter what my opinion is. I don't see a tree stump in a forest and say, oh my God, there's a tree stump here. There's trash. This forest, go on to the fresh one and start fresh. Because it's supposed to be there. And if I'm to believe that my recovery is God-given and God-made, I have to accept everything that's there, no matter what my personal opinion is. And if sometimes I think that maybe I've broken my abstinence, I do not make a decision of whether I have or haven't broken my abstinence for 3 to 6 months. And in 3 to 6 months, I look back and see, did I or didn't I break my abstinence? But just in case I didn't, I'm not going to fuck it up now. So I have to keep on keeping on. And that is why I have 31 years. Thank you.
Thanks a bunch, Mehmet. Our next speaker is John.
Oh, I thought you were doing stuff in the middle. No?
Huh?
I thought you were doing stuff in between the two speakers, but that's okay. No problem. I'm John, compulsive eater.
Hi, John.
I have some notes here, not because I have trouble speaking, it's because I have trouble not speaking, keeping it down. I feel sort of really qualified to talk about relapse because I got 32 years in this program, but 19 years ago, I was in a miserable, miserable relapse. I could not stop eating. I had moved out here from the East Coast, and I was just in a terrible way. And the thing about it is, I wasn't not, you know, I had 13 plus years in program. I wasn't just calling myself a member of Overeaters Anonymous. I was really involved. I was a I remember I was the secretary of Artisan Abstinence Meeting in Hollywood. I was a sponsor. I had a sponsor. I was a delegate. I was doing all this work, and yet I remember leaving the Artisan Abstinence Meeting where I was secretary and stopping at the donut shop on the way home. And as I'm leaving, I'm driving along going, why am I doing this? It's not like I'm sentenced to OA. You know, over in my other program, you can actually get sentenced to have to come to meetings. If I don't want to be here, I don't have to be here. And yet, I mean, the pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization of that, you know, was amazing. And I actually, my road to recovery started really about that time, and it got better. And I've spent the last 19 years looking back at that relapse and really looking at what it was and how what was involved and what didn't I get at the time. And I, you know, there were a couple of things that I, in retrospect, I realized I didn't understand. The number one thing for me was I didn't understand it was a disease. You know, I called it a disease because I'm a good little student, and everybody at the meetings when I came said, oh, it's a disease. So I went, oh, it's a disease, it's a disease. But in here, deep down, it was like, okay, if it makes you guys feel good and it makes you feel okay, call it a disease. And, you know, but I didn't really get it. The other thing I really didn't get was powerlessness and what powerless meant when it came to my food. I certainly, I'm in another program, I understood powerlessness there because if I picked up one drink, I was off to the races, I could not stop. And it's, you know, there's stuff, you know, and this is stuff that's in the big book. It talks about at one point or another we could take it or leave it and then do that. You know, and it's actually now, you know, the amazing thing is scientists have found out that there's actually an enzyme that burns out in the human body if you drink too much. It's, you know, and so there's actually scientific basis for that. But when it came to the food, I would have periods of abstinence, you know, and when I was going through that horrible relapse, it wasn't like, yee-haw, I'd get, you know, a week on, a week off, 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, a month on, a month off. And it was, like I said, it was just, it was something I couldn't understand. And you know, I didn't also understand how the disease actually operated on me and how it attacked me and worked in my brain. And you know, I mean, I got gifted with a wonderful brain as part of, you know, in the deck of cards that got handed out, alcoholic parent, but a good brain, you know. And I've been able to do so many things, but this one area, no matter how much I understood, it wouldn't help. In fact, the more I understood, the more ammunition I gave my disease, you know. And I love, there's a lady named Marcy who always says, you can't fix a broken brain with a broken brain. And that was the part I didn't get, you know. And what I really have come to believe now, after all these years, is I do have a disease. I get it now. I really do. But it's interesting that we see, we a lot of times take ownership of our relapse and all that stuff on ourselves. You know, if we all, most of us have had friends who've had cancer, and they've had cancer and they've had remission, they may have had relapses, and we don't ever say to them, you're such an idiot for getting cancer, or you're, you know, how could you go have a relapse with cancer? What, didn't you learn the first time? Because we get that that's nothing that they want or they desire. But if you think about it, cancer cells are growing in their body. They're not coming from outside. They're growing in their body. And we certainly can wrap our brains around that part when it comes to that kind of a physical thing. But when it comes to something like we have with our disease, which is a cognitive thing, it's hard for us to see, oh, this part of my, this is the disease that's attacking me. And it was always, the thing that I just couldn't wrap my head around was when that thought came, I would just say, oh, I guess I changed my mind. And I never thought about, this is the disease attacking. And to sort of put a face on the disease coming at me from outside. Because that, for many years, it was like, oh, okay, I changed my mind, I ate again. And I mean, I honestly couldn't get it. I mean, today I really do understand it, you know. The thing about powerlessness, again, was I couldn't get that. You know, I had periods of abstinence. I had 3 months. I had a couple of years before I moved out. You know, so I knew I could get abstinent again because I had done it before. So on one level, I'm talking the talk of, oh, yeah, I'm powerless, but in here, I had a number of years of abstinence. I had a slip. I had another number of years. If I've had that, I can get it again. But right there, as long as I'm saying to myself, I had it, I can get it back, even if I do get it back, I'm just setting up the next one out the door. And that was one of the things I couldn't understand. I finally had to admit to myself, no, I am powerful over the food in the small picture. But in terms of pulling back the camera, you know, like that scene in Gone with the Wind where they just keep pulling the camera back, all of a sudden I could see, no, over my lifetime, I was powerless. And for me, the concept of powerlessness in the food had to be different than it is in the alcohol. And it had to mean I am powerless in the big picture. I needed to start seeing it as food could no longer be an option for my emotions. You know, it had to be something, there had to be something else. Now, like Nanette was saying, I've had, you know, food days I'm not proud of, you know. But it's been within the context of meals. It's been, in, you know, it hasn't been, oh, somebody said something to me and sent me off. You know, it's been about that, you know. But I can also say that, you know, it doesn't go away, you know. I mean, I will still have times when my disease is talking to me. And one of the ways I'd sort of describe it is my disease is like the world's best salesman. You know, think of a salesman who's just really good, you know, and they've understood sales. They know you got to be smooth and suave and you got to get the people to like you and all that. Well, this is the world's best salesman. And on top of that, he's the world's best salesman that can read your mind. So not only is he making the pitch to you, everything you're going to say no to, he's got the answer to ahead of time. And so it's, oh, yeah, do this, you know, and all these excuses and all. And then if he does make the sale, and I do pick up the food, as I did many times, after I'm done eating, he puts his arm around my shoulder and says, and by the way, this was your idea. You know, and I hold on to the guilt of, oh my God, I did it again. Why did I do it when I'm going to meetings and doing all that stuff? It's because I just genuinely didn't get how the disease worked for me, you know. The other thing is that, you know, when I really look at it, you know, I needed to understand, you know, what the disease was doing for me. You know, I for me, okay, and this is just my thinking. I read the big book. I'm in a program based on Alcoholics Anonymous, and when I read that big book, I don't ever get in there anywhere. Nothing inferred in there says, oh, when you're done reading all this stuff and when you're done working all these steps, then you will want to put down the booze. You know, it's an implied thing. Hey, you're putting down a substance. you're going to be crazy. Here's how you can get through it, you know? And but part of me didn't ever want to look at that when I was in the relapse, because, you know, and it's so funny, too, because, you know, we talk about abstinence here, and we talk about sobriety in the other program, but if you think about it, abstinence means not doing something. So in a way, AA has abstinence. We have a sober relationship with food, you know? And for me, that's what it had to become. It had to become a sober eating situation. And the problem was, when I was in my disease, it was running the show. It was calling the shots. I could have a choice of going to a 4-star restaurant with some of the best food in the world, but they've got lousy bread. Or I can go to a place with the worst food in the world, but they got good bread. I know which one I would go to, because that happens to be one of my binge foods. And it would make a lot of calls. And it took me a long time to look back and go, God, I was being run so much by my life, my choices, my deciding to isolate, not wanting to have friends because they were going to get in the way of my food, or go out on a date and eat this much and say, well, I got to go, you know, and go home and binge, you know, and things like that. But one of the things that really came to me when I looked back at this disease and the relapse I was in is my disease got up every morning in the middle of my relapse, and it had one job to do. Only one, and that was to convince me any way it could to kick the can down the road another day on actually putting the food down. And if it could do it through convoluted thinking, it could do it from perfectly good program precepts and thoughts, you know, that it can. And as long as it ended with, but, you know, today I'll have this, you know, things that I know I shouldn't be eating, things that were self-destructive for me. And As a result, in these rooms, in my relapse, I became the absolute number one master of OA bullshit, okay? I could make and it's one of the things I tell my sponsees now in meetings, take everything you hear in meetings with a grain of salt. They may be perfectly good, but realize you may be dealing with, you know, in this program, we have one of the most democratic organization in the world. You could binge 2 seconds before you walked in the door, you're going to get your 3 minutes to speak. And in AA, they tend to, you know, if somebody's drunk, they're going to, you know, come outside or something. But I always tell my sponsees, just take everything you hear in a meeting with a grain of salt. If you want to, run it by me, you know, talk. But I was up there, you know, and I made a list of some of the things I wrote, you know, I said over the years. I need to be gentle with myself, you know. What that meant was I was eating the amount of food Henry VIII ate, you know. But this way I could say I was abstinent. I can't be on a diet, you know. That was another one of my... And you know what? We're all on a diet of one kind or another. I've been on a no-liver diet since I left my mother's house, okay? I ate last night, but I won't beat myself up. That was one I used a lot, you know? And I remember coming to the same meeting that we used to meet at the log cabin. We used to have morning meetings. And I think about the third time I did that, an old-timer came up, you know, after I said I ate last night, but I'm not going to beat myself up, and said, wasn't eating last night beating yourself up too? And then I was like, ooh, you know, like all of a sudden, another one's like, I guess I haven't hit my bottom yet, you know, and I heard an old timer say once, you know, bottom's not the goal here. You know, we can bring it up to wherever we are, you know, if we want to. I'll work the steps and then the food will get in order. Again, my disease is just desperately trying to find something that will make me not want to have to put the food down. And it would look for anything. And perfectly good things that program people are saying, but I'm taking it to be, and so this is why I shouldn't eat. You know, I mean, I should eat, you know. You know, I'm praying for the willingness. I was at a convention once, and some lady got up and she said, you know, when it comes to addiction, willingness is highly overrated. You know, said, if Bill and Dr. Bob had waited to be willing to stop drinking, we would never have a program. I mean, I understand the willingness thing, but pain is a way more better motivator for me than willingness, you know. But my all-time favorite was, I remember one time coming and going, I'm redefining my abstinence, you know? You know, and a little voice in my head said, no, you broke your abstinence. You're just redefining your honesty, you know? And it was really true, because I would do these things of, okay, I have 3 meals and a snack. And what that meant was anything I ate after 5 was a snack, you know? And, or, you know, all kinds of crazy stuff. But anyway, the point is that my disease was work, and it wanted so desperately to not have me try to recover, but it was so good and so chameleon-like in its ability to not get me to see, because I didn't really want to eat. I wouldn't be going to those meetings. I wouldn't be doing all this stuff. I wouldn't be good. If I wanted to eat, I would just go eat. Yet at that exact moment, the salesman made the sale and then told me it was my idea. And for me, the thing that had to change was when those ideas come, now the stuff comes into my head, I have to see it as the disease coming at me. And it's hard because it takes a sort of conceptual thing to think of it that way. But I want the recovery. I want the things that it promises me. But my disease, again, is always there. You know, my disease is also big on holding up the balance sheet and saying, look at you, you poor thing. Look at all the things you're not going to get on this list anymore. You don't get to eat this. You don't get to... But it doesn't want to show me the other side of the balance sheet that says, look at this. You don't get winded walking up three stairs anymore. You don't wear your pants out in between here because you're so big that your thighs rub together. You don't find yourself sitting alone on a Saturday night. But at that moment, it's trying to convince me of these things. All those things are out the window. And for me, that was the beginning of things, is to start to realize, you know, get it down on a gut level that I'm powerless over. You know, I'm powerless over the food. At the end of the day, when you strip down all the intellectual stuff, it's all the stuff in the big book. I'm powerless over the food. My life is unmanageable. And for me, the other thing was to recognize that this is hard, what we do here, you know? We have a disease where we have to, so that we have to take the substance into our body, you know, three times a day. And I'm not discounting my alcoholism, but, you know, I put that down 32 years ago, and I used to work as a comedian. I had people standing there at the end of a show with a drink under my nose telling me some long-winded bad joke, and I didn't have the urge to go drink, but... I'm not in a fit spiritual condition, and had a bad day, and when I finished dinner, I wanted to go hit the refrigerator and just keep going, you know? And to admit that this is hard is just, for me, it helps me just not diminish it, you know? Because there's all these other arrows in its quiver, you know? Oh, it's just food, for crying out loud. And plus, it's, for me, this is addiction that started as far back as I can remember, you know? And for some people, especially, you know, like women, it can have to do with body image and sexuality. And you know, it's one of the few, you know, diseases where recovery brings its own set of extra problems sometimes, you know? And so for me, it was about realizing all that stuff. And then again, the idea that, you know, if I'm powerful, and to really grasp the fact that as a result of this disease being in my brain, I am insane. Just what it says in the second step. And I need to find a power greater than myself that can restore me to sanity. And the thing is, for me, I love the 12-step concept of levels of higher powers. You know, the number one thing I got to do, more than admitting that there is a higher power, is admit that I'm a lesser power. You know, that there are, and for me, I need a higher power in terms of what I want to consider, a higher power, God. Many years later, I still have a problem with the word God. It means something to everybody. It means something different, but a lot of old Catholic school tapes in there. But a higher power. But I also need a sponsor. I need my God squad, friends I can call up about different things. And you know, I think it's really, for me, you know, when I was in the middle of this relapse, I really didn't, I didn't need God as much as I needed a sponsor and be willing to take direction. I needed to turn my will and my life over to somebody else at that moment. Because I always joked that I said, you know, if it's just about me and God, I can go into a closet and pray to God and come out convinced that chocolate is a vegetable, you know? Because I prayed and I prayed to God, you know? The trouble is when I pray to any kind of a higher power I want to believe in, I don't know if the response is actually the word, the voice of my higher power, or is it the voice of my disease just doing a really good higher power impression, you know? And that's why when I have those kind of thoughts, I go to my sponsor and say, hey, God told me chocolate's a vegetable. And he's like, yeah, not today, you know? And so, you know, for me, one of the things I talk about a lot, and we don't have the time for this today, is... you know, to put it, one of the current genres that's out there, you know, the film genre out there now that's fairly big is like the zombie apocalypse, right? So if you think of I'm huddled in this house trying to keep the zombies out, which, you know, in my case is the disease, I got to lock the front and back door to keep them out. So for me, the front and back door are the first three steps and the tools. And if I can work those and I can deal with that, I may be able to get the food down. But if I then have to look around and realize there's windows there too. And right now the zombies haven't found the windows yet, but they will. And for me, that's where the rest of the steps have to come in. Because I've seen a lot of people come and go over 32 years. A lot of them with 5, 6, 7, 8 years in program, you know. Two of my sponsees are dead, and a couple of them had a number of years of absence. They did not have it. But so that then, the people who leave, I see that they'll work the steps, they'll use the meetings as a... They'll work the tools, you know, they'll use the meetings, but they won't really do a lot of the recovery, and I think you need that too. But for me, I needed to come in and do some concrete stuff, you know, in the beginning. I needed to start being willing. You know, I heard a speaker this morning who said, I came in, and if my sponsor told me to go do cartwheels out along the side of the road, I'd do it. And that's the thing that... one of the things you need to do, you know. And for me, what the other thing that makes this disease so hard is the way in which it delivers the pain. You know, over in AA and in other drugs, you get slammed down into the pavement. You know, you wake up somewhere you don't want to be, or, you know, in jail or something, and you get a momentary glimmer of, oh my God, what am I doing with my life? The trouble is, this disease works differently. The pain is more chronic. It's slower. The smarter you are, the more you can just keep moving those goalposts and say, well, I'll never get to this, or I'll never do that, you know. And as a result, you it's hard. I always like to say this, that this disease, you know, makes you uncomfortable enough to know you should do something, but not uncomfortable enough all the time to make you willing to go to any lengths. And when I came in, one of the phrases I used to always hear was, take direction. Take direction. Be willing to come in, work with the sponsor, try and come up with a food plan that makes sense. And like Nanette said, you know, for me, I had to find that balance of how to work a food plan that wasn't so onerous, because that's what I want to do, just like Nanette said. And one of the ways I describe it is deciding on a food plan is like having either foot on a stride, a steeply pitched roof. And in either way, you can roll off. The one way to roll off is, well, like I was saying earlier, oh, I ate that, I shouldn't have, but I won't beat myself up. And you just eventually keep doing that, and you roll off, and you're totally face down in a cheesecake. But the other way is, I ate a pea I shouldn't have. Oh, screw it, I'm not perfect anymore, as Annette said, and go off to the races again. And so for me... I feel, and I tell sponsees who are trying to really get their abstinence back on track, focus on those first three steps in the beginning. You know, realize that you have a problem, realize you're crazy, and say, hey, maybe I can get somebody who isn't crazy to help me, and I will take this diseased brain out and take direction for a while and not try to argue about it, because I don't know whether that's me or my disease trying to elbow my sponsor out. And anyway, like I said, and that's been my thing on it, and I'll turn it back to Robin. One bless.
All right, thanks a bunch. We will now have a 10-minute break.
Okay.